lit in Manhattan. He's pleaded not guilty. Dave Packer, ABC.
Lena Bloom for The Bail Project.
Imagine you're stuck in a jail cell and you can't afford bail and someone offers you a way out. Just plead guilty and you can go home and kiss your kids goodnight. What do you do? What thousands have. You plead guilty whether you are or not. Cash bail makes poverty a crime. That's why the Bail Project helps those who can't afford it while fighting to end cash bail. Because freedom should be free.
Brought to you by the Ad Council.
The John and Gordy Show.
Optimism alone is not enough to ward off despair, but hope can. Regardless of how things may turn out, hope is what can still get you to the better place eventually. Mm-hmm. So you don't have hope because you expect things to turn out well. You have hope because what that hope is rooted in is worth it regardless.
Weekday mornings 6 till 8 on 92.7 WMDX.
Rational Revolution with Mark Becker.
Liz Cheney, famous not Democrat, endorsed Kamala Harris for president.
I know that the most conservative of conservative values is fidelity to our Constitution.
Liz Cheney said that.
I tell you, I have never voted for a Democrat, but this year I am proudly casting my vote for Vice President Kamala Harris.
Patriotism above partisanship.
Listen to Rational Revolution with Mark Becker wherever you get your podcasts.
The first time seeing my son, I feel like my life did a 180. He really a definition of like why he loves somebody.
Through all of fatherhood's firsts, never stop being a dad. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Continuing election coverage you won't find anywhere else, including results when the polls close November 5th. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Count on us on air at 92.7 WMDX, on the web at WMDXradio.com, and always on the Civic Media app.
Oh no, stomach issues again?
Stomach issues?
Who are you?
Your pancreas. I could be the real reason for your diarrhea, gas, bloating, stomach pain, or loose oily stools.
I thought it was my stomach.
People often do, but any of these symptoms could mean having a condition called exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, or EPI. With EPI, the pancreas doesn't release enough enzymes to break down food, but EPI is manageable. Use the symptom checker on identifyepi.com and speak with your doctor. That's identifyepi.com. Sponsored by AbbVie.
Hear full election coverage of this campaign Tuesday night on 92.7 WMDX. Join us as we cover everything from the pre-poll closing to post-poll closing, analysis and results, all night long until the final results are in. Coverage is being brought to you by Chad's Design Build, sustainable renovations and construction since 1992, online at chadsdesignbuild.com. Be here Tuesday night starting at 6.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Over the last week, clerks around Wisconsin have been putting their election equipment to the test. It's a common practice. They've been doing it for years. But these days, they hope inviting the public to see it all for themselves helps prevent misinformation. Mike Moen reports.
According to the Wisconsin Elections Commission, all municipalities must conduct a public test of their electronic voting equipment within 10 days of each election. Algoma City Clerk Aaron Miller describes it as a pretty detailed run-through.
We will take the voting machine out of the vault, and we will go through the whole process of putting the cartridges in the places where they're supposed to go, adding the safety seals, recording the safety seals, and then putting the test ballots through the machine to ensure accuracy.
In a recent Gallup poll, 57% of Americans say they're confident votes for president this year will be accurately counted. However, partisan gaps have widened, with faith and accuracy waning among Republican respondents. In a battleground state like Wisconsin, Miller says these tests are important so administrators can show how consistent they are in overseeing elections. She says they're a good training opportunity, too.
I have my poll workers put a blank ballot through so they can see what happens, you know, with the machine. I have them put a ballot that somebody maybe happened to overvote in a certain selection, so they can see how the machine is going to react to that.
If something abnormal pops up during testing, state law requires local clerks to remedy the situation before voters can use that machine on election day. Administrators around the country have said they're relying on aging voting equipment, with calls to boost federal funding for that type of infrastructure. Miller says her team is lucky because their machines were recently upgraded. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
More news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 50s. Tonight, rain after midnight, low of 42. Rain is likely for Sunday, with highs in the low 60s. Sunday night, showers and storms, temperatures around 60 degrees. For Monday, more rain and a high near 69.
Currently 33 degrees.
T. Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I'm live from our Madison studio, where I welcome King of the Hill and Futurama TV writer Mike Rowe and musician Eric Gelland from Mascot Theory joins me in the studio.
Nightlight with T. Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8. Welcome to Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this broadcast on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. This is our weekend weekly wrap-up, our analysis, our review, our examination of the recent news stories in the areas of law and government, and yes, indeed, the aspiration for justice in America and beyond. Delighted to have you, honored to have you with me and my producer, Max, this weekend as we take on those important issues affecting our lives and our livelihoods in our state, in our nation, and on the face of this planet. As always, inviting as well your inquiries, your questions, even your commentary about the things on our ambitious but achievable agenda, our syllabus for discussion in those areas of government, law, and justice as we pursue all of those most recent news stories populating our newspapers, populating the media just this past week. Let me begin by talking with you a bit about that syllabus. Again, recognizing that it spans many, many areas geographically and also issues across the board. We're going to begin, as we did last week, talking about things not in the area of campaigns, although we're going to get back to that very shortly. The campaigns here in the United States of America. We're going to go south for a few minutes. We're going to go to Mexico and talk about some major rule of law challenges going on right now in that nation, having to do with judicial reform. Something significant happened, not only with respect to the Supreme Court in that nation, but also the response and the contemporaneous action of the legislature. They're basically attempting to shut down any challenges to recent legislative changes that would affect the judiciary. It is too much to say there is a crisis going on right now in Mexico, but there is certainly a fight, a very strong fight between the legislature and the Mexican Supreme Court about the future of justice in that nation. We know that Mexico most recently elected its first woman president in its history. That woman is now at the head of the party that is leading the reforms that have drawn the ire, the criticism of the Supreme Court. We'll talk about what exactly is going on and not going on in Mexico these days. And then, yes, we're going to be continuing our focus just days away from the election on things related to a possible future presidency by Donald Trump. We began last week by talking a lot about the ways in which a president, any president, could use, should not use, but could use the Department of Justice for political purposes. We'll talk about the limits of that. We'll remind all of us about the things that Donald Trump has said, talking about jailing his rivals. Can he do that? Are the mechanisms in place? Are the structures there inside the Department of Justice permit a president, any president, including Donald Trump, to use the trappings of the Department of Justice to jail rivals, to engage in retribution against them for perceived ills and wrongs? We'll talk about the limits on that power. We're going to be assuming once again a structure that talks about internal Justice Department mechanisms having to do with appointments. We'll talk about investigations and the ways in which those could and cannot be used to do what Donald Trump wants to do. And then another safeguard, which is, of course, the grand jury, judges generally. We'll talk about all of those things, asking the simple but important question, can Donald Trump do what he pretends to do if he becomes the president, which is use the Department of Justice for political retribution? The answer is no, with a small n, but also with some compromises to the Department of Justice, as we know, in the wake of that major Supreme Court case, effectively granting him, any president who may occupy the White House, almost complete immunity with respect to many things, including absolute immunity for things related to the Department of Justice. That's part two. Begun last week, continuing this week, our examination of that, and also focusing on this thing called the unitary executive theory, UET. What does that mean? Why is it being bandied about now in the present campaign? And how does it intersect with this notion of increased power inside an executive branch to be used or not used, depending upon who is elected next Tuesday? Then, of course, we're going to go to some major news in the area of voting. Lots of important things coming out of places like Pennsylvania, like Virginia, Mississippi. Lots and lots of decisions being made, not only by local and state courts, but significantly the Supreme Court. Yes, that's right. The United States Supreme Court once again weighing in, or actually not weighing in, on some of these issues that do have an impact upon who is voting and not voting on Tuesday. And that includes Virginia, an effort by the governor, the legislature there, to purge the voters, some voters, about 1,600 of them, from the existing polls. We'll talk about Pennsylvania, the counting of ballots, in particular what the Supreme Court did that permits the filing, the submission of provisional ballots to ensure that some of the laws there in Pennsylvania do not prohibit the franchise being extended to everyone. There's also some interesting litigation coming out of Bucks County having to do with mail-in ballots, and some things having to do in Mississippi with the same kind of thing. All of that going on in the courts just days, really even hours before the election itself is underway. Virginia, Pennsylvania, much in our news analysis this weekend on Amicus, a law review. And then necessarily, we're going to talk a little bit about what the Supreme Court is going to be doing this coming week, even as we're going to the polls and counting the election results. Supreme Court back in business this week. Additional cases. We'll tell you a little bit more about what those cases are all about. And then, of course, we know that regardless of what happens on Tuesday, regardless of what the ultimate result is, perhaps not realized, counted, fully acknowledged and embraced until later in the week, we know that there are some things going on in November in the New York Manhattan Criminal Court. Yes, that's right. Judge Juan Merchan, lest we forget, has scheduled the criminal sentencing of Donald Trump for November 26, just 3 weeks after the election itself. Donald Trump previously having been convicted by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt of 34 counts of violations of New York state law involving fraudulent submissions, fraudulent records, false documents. All of that coming to a head, according to Juan Merchan, the presiding judge. He is going to sentence a defendant named Donald John Trump based upon that conviction way back in May, almost 6 months ago. Now, finally, a sentencing coming up right before Thanksgiving. That presumably will happen regardless of whether Donald Trump is elected our next president or not. The judge going ahead in the context of Donald Trump, defendant, not president-elect or not private citizen. That is going to happen in late November. Another milestone, a stunning milestone in the history of America. All that coming up and more this weekend on Amicus, a Law Review. Delighted once again to have you joining me for our discussion, our engagement on these important pre-election issues here in the United States of America, affecting plainly Wisconsin, states beyond, and the entire world. And speaking of that, let's begin by talking about our world and rule of law issues in the context of what's going on these days in Mexico. We have talked about this before. We know that the Mexican legislature has recently, with the endorsement of the new president, her name is Claudia Sheinbaum, S-H-E-I-N-B-A-U-M. Claudia Sheinbaum, a major historical figure now, not only because of what she is doing in that nation, but because she is the first woman president ever elected to the chief executive office in that country. She and her party putting together some major, major reforms when it comes to the courts in Mexico, rule of law issues implicated, raising high the focus on what's happening with judicial decision making and how judges are elected and appointed, selected in Mexico. That has drawn the ire, the attention, the disgust, the disappointment of justices of the Supreme Court who this past week have promised to resign, eight of them, in the wake of what she, the president, and the legislature are doing. Let's talk about what is happening with respect to the legislature just this past week, and then also the response in the midst of all of this by the Supreme Court. Mexico's lower house of Congress, they also have a bicameral legislature just like we do, approved some sweeping new measures just this past week that, get this, would prevent legal challenges to constitutional amendments. In other words, proposals for changing the Constitution. The legislation that is proposed would shut those down, allowing lawmakers to reshape the country's charter without any judicial review. No involvement of judges, courts, when it comes to reviews of what the legislature does to change the Constitution. The bill itself, again, pending in the Congress there, already passed by the Senate last week. This has gone through the Senate and has been passed already, drawing criticism from lots of people out there, legal scholars, some human rights experts, very concerned about all this, who are saying it would bulldoze any judicial oversight of constitutional matters and hand the ruling party is called the Morena Party, M-O-R-E-N-A, again, led by the president, seemingly some unchecked, unfettered power to pass some really significant, profound changes to the laws governing that nation. The details, of course, of the bills are still subject to review, and this is still in the Congress in Mexico. But most state legislatures are expected to approve the measure in the coming days, meaning that this is going to go forward. And the move, of course, comes at a very tense moment in Mexico, as I've already described, in which the major branches of government are basically at war with a small W. Not physically war, but they are battling each other, battling toward a fundamental disagreement about who should be in charge of democracy and the republic and how that is administered between the legislature and the courts. Now, how did we get here? Again, we've talked about this in the past. We know that the fight, this present dispute between the legislature and courts and the objection to the ways in which this is being done began basically when the Moreno Party and its allies won this landslide victory this past summer. And they used that power to effect and accomplish some major judicial overhauls just last month. And the new measure appears to be a direct response to efforts to block that overhaul. In other words, legislature coming back and saying, we're going ahead with these changes. Don't mess with this. Don't challenge us in court. And the latest salvo is exactly what we're going to be talking about as Amicus Law Review continues to focus on Mexico and this fight between the Supreme Court and the legislature having to do with the rule of law and the future of justice in the Mexican nation. Stay with me for all of that.
This is Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
It was the most embarrassing moment of the Senate debate. Eric Hovde didn't know what was in the farm bill.
I'm not an expert on the farm bill.
Really? One out of nine Wisconsinites work in agriculture. But billionaire California banker Eric Hovde couldn't be bothered to learn about the farm bill. Hovde even said, quote, "Why in God's green earth would I know all the details in the farm bill?" The Wisconsin Farm Bureau has endorsed Tammy Baldwin. She's the first statewide Democrat they've endorsed in over 20 years. The Farm Bureau says Tammy Baldwin has been, quote, a steadfast advocate for Wisconsin agriculture. They cite her work creating the Dairy Business Innovation Act, which is helping farmers across Wisconsin expand and hire new workers. It's a clear choice. Billionaire California banker Eric Hovde, who doesn't give a damn about farmers, or Tammy Baldwin, who's working hard for us.
I'm Tammy Baldwin, running for Senate, and I approve this message.
Paid for by Tammy Baldwin for Senate.
A voice for Madison. Real news and great conversation. 92.7 WMDX.
This is Amicus, a lot of you talking in our initial segments this weekend about what's going on in Mexico. Some significant rule of law challenges there, some disputes between the legislature and the Supreme Court. The judicial redesign that has already been accomplished by the legislature, although not without great challenge, and that's the point. The judicial redesign requires the popular election of judges across the board in Mexico, including members of the Supreme Court. And it also subjects them to, get this, something that we could learn from here in the United States of America, subjects those justices, those judges, to review by a disciplinary tribunal made up of elected officials with broad powers to investigate and even impeach judges. That's what the legislature has put in place that has caused this later skirmish, this later disagreement between the legislature and the Supreme Court. Proponents of this proposal, of course, as it's going forward, says it will help to rid the system of corruption, provide accountability, the people themselves electing the judges, including the justices of the Supreme Court, get rid of nepotism, which is, again, a huge problem in many nations, including Mexico. Critics argue that this proposal will erode judicial independence, something we talk a lot about when it comes to the rule of law, this notion that judges should be free from outside sources and outside influences when making decisions, would politicize the courts, they say, requiring judges to run for office just like other representatives are required to do. The overhaul was meant to accomplish those kinds of things, to provide more accountability inside the Mexican judiciary. More than 500 legal actions, 500 lawsuits filed in various courts in Mexico to challenge that, seeking to block the approval of this, to go back to keep things in place as they were before. The implementation opposed by various civic groups, politicians, judges themselves, all kinds of people out there litigating about whether or not these changes in Mexico's judiciary should happen. And that is what prompts the most recent activity. Instead of responding to those rulings and those attempts inside the courts to address what's going on there, the Sheinbaum administration has opted for a much more simple route. They've simply disregarded those and have said, we're going ahead. And the newest change, again, proposed and seemingly passing in the Senate and now soon the House as well there, is simply to say that all those challenges cannot go ahead. A legislative enactment that prohibits you from going into Mexican court to challenge the very processes, the principles that have already been put in place. Now, needless to say, that is also raising an awful lot of concern, challenge, disagreement, downright opposition, objection, outrage by an awful lot of people who say you can't shut down the courts. That's our remedy. And indeed, the other shoe that's dropping just this past week, in addition to that legislative attempt to shut down what you can do in Mexico to address these legislative changes, is that the Supreme Court has now responded. Needless to say, the Supreme Court, not happy with the initial proposal to require that they run for office. They've never had to do that before, always been appointed for long terms of office. The Supreme Court now doing something dramatic, which we have not seen in this nation. We have had individual resignations, of course, of judges as they basically have retired, left the bench. We've got a number of Supreme Court justices who right now are still alive and much active in our public domain, but they have resigned. They have retired from their positions. That's not this. in a terse, a very, very confrontational series of resignation letters sent just this past week, eight of Mexico's 11 Supreme Court justices have said that they're going to step down from their posts instead of participating in this contentious election of thousands of judges in 2025, basically saying, we're not participating in this. We are opposed to it. The legislation cannot do this. We should remain in positions as we are, appointed judges and justices. And we're so angry about it that we're leaving office. Now, they haven't left office right away. They're announcing those retirements, those resignations for mid-2025. Plainly, this is, however, the latest volley in this ongoing battle over this judicial overhaul passed by the ruling party most recently. And it promises to continue to upend this system while the legislature, again, continues to pass legislation, most recently to try to stop anybody from challenging the very things that they've already put in place. The resignations follow these attacks on the courts by President Claudia Sheinbaum and other prominent members of her party who have alleged, once again, nepotism, corruption, the kinds of things that they say warrants the decision to make them elected judges as opposed to appointed judges. The redesign of the judiciary requires that all of the nation's judges be elected in 2025, subjecting them once again to discipline, to what we might call an ethics review, an ethics set of codes, some regulations there. Also the subject of a huge amount of focus here in our nation as well, and requiring them to be subjected to investigation and even impeachment if they should act in a way that's contrary to a perceived judicial integrity system. Supporters again say that corruption will be addressed by this, and opponents say that it undermines independence of the judiciary there in Mexico. The dismantling of the judiciary is not the way forward. That's the comment by the Chief Justice of the Mexican Supreme Court. She says, this resignation does not imply my agreement with the separation from the position for which I was originally appointed until December 10 of 2030. That's Chief Justice Norma Piña. She wrote that in her letter of resignation. She said, but rather this is an act of congruence and respect for the constitutional text that governs us today. She's invoking the Constitution to say she is the one, and the other justices who are joining her in leaving the court, saying we're not participating in a system that's contrary to the rule of law, contrary to the Constitution, on the other side of the political aisle, if you will, the other side of the rule of law aisle, are those members of the ruling party in the legislature who say, no, we have to do this. We've got to provide accountability for the judiciary. And to the extent that you think you can overrule us by a judicial intervention on that very issue of election and accountability, we're going to shut down any capacity for you to go into court and seek remedies against our action and for in favor of the very people who presumably would be deciding those cases. It is complicated. It is a lot. And while it's too much to say it's a constitutional crisis, that's something else. That's a term that's overused and bandied about with great regularity here in our country and other places. It is a crisis. And we will continue to watch here on Amicus, a Law Review, those goings on in Mexico, reminding us that they are our republic, their republic, and the judiciary is a significant part of our system of justice, administration of rule of law, the delivery that government promises to us to provide redress of grievances in our courts. When these kinds of things happen, all of that is potentially compromised. No clear winners, no clear losers on this right now, but a continuing battle there in Mexico over the rule of law. And as the rule of law, of course, continues to be on the ballot here in America, this coming Tuesday, we'll turn back to America and talk about the prospect of using the Department of Justice to accomplish or not accomplish justice in our nation as Amicus, a Law Review, continues.
A new choice. Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Just 3 days until Election Day, over 70 million people have already voted. Turnout's already approaching half of the final number from 2020. That set a record. Rallying in Milwaukee, Wisconsin Friday night, former President Trump suggesting Kamala Harris doesn't have what it takes to go toe-to-toe with world leaders.
She will get overwhelmed, she will melt down, and millions of people will die with her stupidity.
ABC Selena Wang covering the Harris campaign.
In these final days, Vice President Harris is stressing that Donald Trump's language is becoming more extreme. And we're learning new details about Harris's plans the day before the election. Her campaign is planning to hold rallies in all seven battlegrounds, tying them together in a national live stream.
Harris in Georgia and North Carolina today. Trump also rallies in North Carolina. Richard Moore put to death by the state of South Carolina Friday night for the 1999 shooting of a convenience store clerk. Daylight saving time ends tonight. Set your clocks back an hour before you hit the sack. This is ABC News.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed. Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
It's the Packers and the Lions. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The top two teams in the North Division meet tomorrow. Green Bay against the Detroit Lions at Lambeau Field. Showers expected. It looks like Jordan Love will be able to play, but his center, Josh Myers, who has a severe left wrist injury, is listed as doubtful.
I think the big thing for me is I just got to make sure I'm not going to hurt the team by playing. So I just have to answer that question.
Kickoff at 3:25. Baseball, the Brewers are getting Rhys Hoskins back. The 31-year-old first baseman will earn $18 million and says after leaving the Phillies, the Brewers were always at the top of his list.
Milwaukee was always a great paper fit, as I can stand back and kind of take a 10,000-foot view of baseball itself and where I may fit in that as an athlete and as a competitor. So I'm glad we're able to kind of get the nitty-gritty and all the details done just because it's such a great fit.
That's the Brewers' Rhys Hoskins. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 50s. Tonight, rain after midnight, low of 42. Rain is likely for Sunday, with highs in the low 60s. Sunday night, showers and storms, temperatures around 60 degrees. For Monday, more rain and a high near 69.
It's 34 at our studios.
Lost in the search for your next home? The Aaron Weber Group has teamed with Compass to point you in the right direction. Spoiler alert, it's toward your dream home. Bigger yard? Compass says head north. More closet space? Compass says go west. Haunted basement? Yeah, maybe steer clear of that one. With the Aaron Weber Group and Compass, you won't go in circles, because when it comes to real estate, we always point you in the right direction. The Aaron Weber Group, powered by Compass, at movetomadison.com.
Listen to the John and Gordy Show weekdays right here on WMDX, sponsored by Verlo Mattress. Sleep better, dream bigger on a handcrafted, locally made mattress. Find them on Madison's East and West Side or online at verlo.com.
Wisconsin has many state symbols, but did you know there's an official ballad?
Oh, Wisconsin, land of my dreams.
Oh, Wisconsin, land of my dreams, composed by Sherry Sarazin.
I don't think it was an hour, and I had the music matched up.
With long ago help from her grandmother.
She wrote a poem in the late 1920s about where she lived in Wisconsin.
And it's now the state ballad. So are these also official Wisconsin symbols? The Kringle, Wood Violet, American Water Spaniel? The answer coming up. The official process can take years and includes advocating the legislature to make it law. Now, along with the official ballad, are the Kringle, Wood Violet, and American Water Spaniel also state symbols? Yes, each is a celebration of the state and a slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network. Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey everybody, join us next time as we will look back at the weekend's news and also preview the election coming up on Tuesday, a special edition. Join us then.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this hour and also next hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. We are talking about all things law and government and justice related this weekend, as always, focusing now on the United States of America and continuing now the second portion of what we began in our last week broadcast, and that is the viability, the options available to any president to use the United States Department of Justice in a way that would accomplish retribution, movement against opposition to rivals out there. We know that Donald Trump, during the course of the campaign, continuing as late as recent days, has promised that if he becomes the president of the United States of America, he will invoke the trappings, the structures, the mechanisms of the United States Department of Justice to go after his rivals. And he has identified them. He's identified them as Hillary Clinton. He's identified them as Joe Biden. He's identified them as Kamala Harris and others who are his political enemies, as he has called them. And the question we began to address last week is, can he do that? Can he use the Department of Justice to investigate, initiate criminal or other prosecutions against people he does not like? Can he upend the basic structures that have existed in the United States of America for 240 years and use those trappings to go after the people he does not like? The question, of course, raises as significant issues about structure and mechanisms. I'm going to talk more about those right now. I'm going to go back and provide some more basic foundational understanding of this by doing a little civics here on our weekend broadcast, as we sometimes do. I'm going to talk about something called the unitary executive theory. The unitary executive theory. Here is your law school primer for the day. It's a constitutional law theory. And we'll put the word theory in quotes because it really does not have foundation that is recognized by legitimate scholars and legitimate legislators and jurists on all sides of the political aisle. But it's another one of these phrases that has been out there, frankly, for a long period of time since the Reagan administration. It's been a concept that the Reagan administration and supporters of his back then invoked, sometimes referred to as Unitarians, contending that the executive branch, in particular the president, has great authority even beyond what we've come to understand in the 21st and 20th centuries, basically bringing in and consolidating power in the White House, in the Oval Office, with respect to all sorts of agency actions and involvements. We know that a couple of things happened in the Supreme Court just this past term. We know that in that case called Loper Bright Enterprises, we've talked a lot about on this broadcast, the Supreme Court stunningly overturned about 40 years of history and said that judges, federal judges, no longer have to or should defer to the wisdom, the expertise, the insight, the background of experts, people who know what they're talking about inside of agencies. It was an attempt to say, you know what? Those agencies don't know what they're talking about, and judges do. That's Loper Bright Enterprises changing the way in which America works, in which you are engaged with those agencies. And that is related to this concept called the unitary executive theory, because it's also an attack upon those agencies, saying that even those agencies out there, like the Federal Trade Commission, the Federal Communications Commission, the Small Business Administration, others around the cabinet table that have some independence from the president himself or herself, all of that should be drawn in and all of that should be under the unitary discretionary oversight and judgment of a president. We also know that much related to this, of course, is that major decision in United States versus Trump, establishing, contrary to what all of us have believed for hundreds of years in America, that our presidents do in fact have some immunities from criminal prosecution for crimes that they might commit in office, as stunning as that concept is. Those two things, Loper Bright Enterprises and United States versus Trump, much related to this notion of a unitary executive theory, because like that Trump case, the unitary executive theory says that the presidency, the executive branch, all powerful, strong and needs to be muscular. And therefore, this notion that somehow there should be some independence, some separateness from the White House among other agencies, we can't be having that. And so the unitary executive theory basically says that there is an expansive interpretation under the Constitution that aims to centralize power over the government in the White House. And it invokes a couple of things in the Constitution. This is the theory. These are the predicates for this notion. The vesting clause of Article 2, perhaps most cited in favor of this kind of strong executive, says just this: the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. And the interpretation there is just this: that the executive power includes agencies, includes administrative actions. And if that is vested in a president, that means, according to this theory, that the president has control and authority and responsibility over all of those agencies, many of which, to greater and lesser degrees, are independent of the presidency. That's the vesting clause that people point to justify this unitary executive theory. There's a second portion of it, which we have also talked about at great length on this broadcast, and that is the take care clause, part of the oath of office that the next president will take on January 20th of 2025, is to take care that the laws, the Constitution of the United States of America, are faithfully executed. The president, the Constitution says, shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And according to the invocation of that, that means that the president is responsible for virtually everything, responsible for oversight of these agencies, and that the president should be the one to decide how those agencies work in the faithful execution, taking care of government, taking care that the laws of our nation are faithfully executed. Those are sort of the constitutional, although in the end, unfounded bases for this thing called the unitary executive theory. Now, why am I talking all about this? Why engage in this civic lesson? A little bit of law school this weekend on Amicus, a law review. The answer is that's being articulated in the present political campaign. You may not have heard a lot about it. It's not on the advertisements. It's not in the flyers you get at home. It's not even in the folks who come and advocate at your doors for the election of one candidate or another. All of those kinds of things. Good advocacy. That's what campaigns should be about. Aggressive attempt to get your vote. In the context of that, not a lot of discussion about what does indeed sound very wonky, very, very, very academic, a unitary executive theory, but it is implicit, and it is the legal side of what is being advanced as a superpower, super empowered presidency of the United States of America. And in particular, there are two groups that have advocated for that. We've talked at great length about one of them. One of them is the Heritage Foundation, and it is the publisher of this thing called Project 2025. We have spent a lot of time talking about various aspects of that in our previous broadcasts. There is a second group that we began to talk about last week as well that likewise embraces this unitary executive theory in Project 2025 and in a second publication called the America First Agenda. The America First Agenda by another group similar to but different from the Heritage Foundation. That group is called the America First Policy Institute. It also is one of these think tanks. It's one of these groups that is formulating what a Trump administration would look like, and it embraces directly and indirectly the unitary executive theory. It contemplates that inside what is admittedly a much slimmer version of Project 2025 in a document called the America First Agenda. Its project also contemplates a superpowered presidency. And that's why this unitary executive theory is so important to understand. And yes, indeed, it is academic in its articulation, but it's very practical in its implementation. The vision by the America First Agenda, again, articulated by this group called the America First Policy Institute, parallel to the Heritage Foundation, parallel to Project 2025, it calls, among other things, for halting federal funding for Planned Parenthood, for mandatory ultrasounds before abortions, stopping all of that from happening, including those carried out
with medication. It seeks to make concealed weapons permits reciprocal in all 50 states. In other words, due course and due observance in all states of concealed weapons permits and authorizations across the nation. It contemplates increased petroleum production at a time when clean energy and legislation passed by the Congress, endorsed by the president, and now in effect across America, is attempting to wean us off those kinds of reliances. It removes the United States from the Paris Agreement, also a lot subject to discussion in this present campaign. It imposes work requirements on Medicare recipients and establishes, get this, only two legal genders. All that is a part of this America First agenda being advanced. And how do you accomplish all that? You embrace the unitary executive theory. You say that all of that is a part of the work of agencies. Who is responsible for those agencies? Who makes the decisions inside all of that in all kinds of areas of our lives and livelihood? The answer is a strong president. And that's why this academic civics lesson about the UET, the unitary executive theory, is most important. And it goes significantly beyond Project 2025. That is the group, the publication of this sister group called the Heritage Foundation, in one key area. It calls, consistent with the unitary executive theory, for the elimination, getting rid of nearly all civil service protections for federal workers by making them at-will employees. And that is a strategy, of course, that supporters believe will allow Mr. Trump or anybody who occupies the presidency to root out career staff members who they interpret as standing in the way of the goals and policies of the administration. Getting rid of civil service protections that have attended upon tens of thousands of civil servants, again, who come to work every day, who try to do their jobs in a thoughtful way, who progress through their days in a way that is focused upon the facts, the applications of regulations and laws to benefit you. Do they get it right all the time? Of course not. There are times when they make mistakes, and that's why you've got the courts. That's why you've got the ability to appeal their decisions. This proposal to limit civil service protections is also a part of the unitary executive theory, this notion that we can get rid of people inside the agencies who might be contrary to our particular views inside the White House, those of the president. The Institute's policy book states this. It says agencies should be free to remove employees for any non-discriminatory reason with no external appeals, turning them all into at-will employees. And again, the change would arguably allow officials to fire civil servants for almost any reason, including defying the administration, speaking out on positions like acknowledging climate change or other things, economic policy, education policy. And indeed, that is a part of the advocacy of this group called the America First Policy Institute and its manifesto now out there. And that is why this is also very important. It is implicit in much of the campaign literature, much of the campaign attack. You have seen it as an attack upon this great, dark, opaque administrative state. And perhaps that's where you've heard it the most often in the political discourse. But that's what this is all about. And the reason why it's so important to understand that is because it's not just political language. It's not just trying to indicate to you that this is our plan. There are lawyers, there are people who are studying this closely who say we've got theories that will make this happen. And indeed, Donald Trump has said the same thing. And he has said that directly and indirectly. He has embraced many of the things that have been articulated by the America First Policy Institute in its manifesto, advocating for the unitary executive theory. And in that connection, another part of accomplishing all of this, of course, is to use the Department of Justice, as I've indicated in our previous broadcast and again this weekend. Using the Department of Justice, of course, which the Supreme Court has said the president can use as he will with impunity. As we continue our discussion, we'll talk about that important question about whether unitary executive theory and all of this can be accomplished by the president in affecting the ways that the Department of Justice, your Department of Justice, works and functions. Stay with us for that.
Welcome to Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
It's time to get out the truth about Eric Hovde. Hovde made his money the old-fashioned way. He inherited it. How can he relate or make decisions for us? Now he's the CEO of a billion-dollar bank in California and a huge landlord. With people like Eric Hovde, the rich pay less, and we pay the price. I'm not a political person. I'm a mom. I would never vote for a person like Eric Hovde.
Paid for by a Better Wisconsin Together Action, abwt-action.org. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
The Todd Albaugh Show.
Either Donald Trump or Kamala Harris is going to win this race. Don't be the person saying, I agree with Kamala Harris on 80%, but I was really ticked off about X. I wanted to send her a message, so I didn't vote or I voted for someone else. And then you get Trump, and people are going to say, you can't have a national abortion ban. They have to listen to us. We're the people. It'll be too late. Your vote is powerful. Do not waste it.
The Todd Albaugh Show. Weekdays, noon till 2, on your local civic media radio station and on the app. This is Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
This is Amicus, a law review. We are spending our time this weekend talking about the implications articulated by the Trump administration of what Donald Trump will do if and when he becomes the president of the United States of America. Embracing not only this so-called academic theory, it really isn't academic, it's really not founded in an accurate or even tempered application of the Constitution, but there are people out there who say that it is and that it does have legs and it would be a part of the cornerstone of a Trump administration. A part of that, the implementation of all this, the consolidation of power inside a unitary presidency inside the Oval Office, getting rid of the discretion previously vested by the legislature in our agencies across the board. Part of that is also changing the way in which the president and the Department of Justice work and operate. We know from our previous discussions that the tradition in both Republican administrations and Democratic administrations, not without exceptions, especially in the previous Trump administration. Nonetheless, the tradition has been an arm's length relationship. Can a president describe and prescribe for an attorney general the broad scope of things that he or she wants the Department of Justice to do? Absolutely. And so presidents can and do campaign and say, I want my Department of Justice to focus more on antitrust issues, more on tax issues, more on environmental issues, more on civil rights issues, more on civil issues regarding all sorts of things related to the administration of civil laws in America, more on immigration, all kinds of things, law enforcement, policing issues. Those broad things can and are appropriate for a president to articulate in direction to his or her Department of Justice. And that's what good presidents have done in the past. What they haven't done is use the Department of Justice for particular prosecutions of rivals. And that is what distinguishes Donald Trump from all the other presidents, Republican and Democrat, who have gone before him. Donald Trump has said that he is going to go after his political rivals. And the question is, can he do that? Are there things inside the Department of Justice that would make it possible for him to accomplish what he is saying on the campaign trail? The preliminary answer is no, but with a small n. Can he change the department? Absolutely. Can he accomplish ultimately his goals? We'd like to think not, because there are still sufficient safeguards and guardrails out there to prevent that from happening. We'll talk about all of those, but let's talk about what the president can, in fact, do. Well, we know, of course, that the president has great authority when it comes to appointing people to the United States Department of Justice. That includes an attorney general, the second in command, the deputy attorney general. Right now, her name is Lisa Monaco. You know the attorney general. His name is Merrick Garland. There is an associate attorney general responsible for civil litigation. There are all sorts of assistant attorneys general who are responsible for all of those kinds of other areas, like tax and like environment and like civil and national security and antitrust, all kinds of things out there. And all of those are appointed by the president. And they can, in fact, be encumbered by
what Donald Trump has said would be people loyal to me, people who may have the qualifications but would also be beholden to a president. And so the president does have authority to appoint those people. Of course, that would give him access to a vast machinery inside the Department of Justice, including criminal law enforcement. And that, of course, also includes 92 United States attorneys around the nation. Under the Obama administration, I was honored by you and by the president, by Attorney General Eric Holder, to serve as the United States attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin in that term. And it comes with the oath of office to uphold the law, to administer it apolitically, in a nonpartisan way. Those people, those U.S. attorneys, like the people at Maine Justice, those assistant attorneys general and others, could be regarded as loyalists to the president himself. Now, what is the big check? What is the big check on all that? Of course, it is that the Constitution says that those people can only be appointed upon the advice and consent of the Senate. My nomination by President Obama was subject to review by, and it was confirmed by, the Senate. And so there is that check. And depending upon who you, the American public, those of us in Wisconsin, states beyond, send to the United States Senate, a third of the Senate up for election this coming Tuesday, depending upon who you send to the Senate, that advise and consent responsibility is going to be used seriously or not. And depending upon the majority of the Senate, it is possible that loyalists in U.S. attorney positions, in those other assistant attorney general positions at Maine Justice, could be subject to easy and quick advice and consent by a Senate that is consistent with and in concert with a president who wants to place his loyalists in those positions. The good news would be, of course, if regardless of the Senate composition, Republican or Democratic, majority controlled, if they all address this in the context in which those nominations should be, which is this person qualified? Should they be vested with this great non-political, apartisan authority? But with a Senate that is in the same party as the presidency, that process could be much easier to appoint loyalists and keep people in those positions who are loyal to the positions of the president. One of the most powerful appointees within the Justice Department is the FBI. People forget sometimes that the FBI is a unit. It is an agency of the Department of Justice. It's not an independent authority. The director of the FBI right now, his name is Chris Wray. He reports to the Attorney General of the United States of America, along with many other agencies like the ATF and the DEA. All sorts of other criminal investigative authorities report to the Attorney General. Now, why is that important? Well, again, the directors of the FBI serve for 10-year terms. But as president, Donald Trump could break that norm, could fire Chris Wray, as he's done before. We know that Donald Trump fired Wray's predecessor, James Comey. Remember that? In 2017, you could fire that person. And of course, the possibility of appointing there, again, subject to Senate confirmation, a loyalist to you. All of those kinds of things indicate that indeed the president does have authority, if the Congress is willing to go along with him or her one day, to appoint people in these positions who are political, who are advocating not on behalf of the American public, or at least not principally, but who are the loyalists about whom Donald Trump has commented in this election. And of course, along the way, he's also got other opportunities to do things inside the Department of Justice once those people are there, to establish policies and practices on areas like immigration, the Southwest border, things having to do with all kinds of issues in connection with the economy, even with education, with commerce, all kinds of things you may not think are inside justice issues, but that do have implications for our nation generally. As we continue, we'll talk more about what Donald Trump can and cannot do inside the Department of Justice and the guardrails that are up against him for accomplishing everything that he wants to do, as Amicus Law Review continues.
A voice for Madison. Real news and great conversation. 92.7 WMDX. John Peterson and Gordy Young.
On our next program, is it the last gasp of democracy?
Is it the pre-election depression special on the John and Gordy Show?
Tune in.
The John and Gordy Show, weekday mornings 6 till 8.
Football season is back, and Gabriel the Promoter is ready to help you get the party started. Celebrate in style by booking a $100 round-trip party bus shuttle from Madison to Lambeau Field, complete with all-you-can-drink Miller Lite. Tickets to the game are not included. Don't miss out on the ultimate green and gold experience. Book your spot now. Brought to you by Gabriel Promotes and sponsored by Baldwin Street Grill. Call Gabriel the Promoter today, 414-944-1704, while spots are still available.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app. This is 92.7 WMDX Columbus, Madison's home for real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.